Where in the Bible do we find the Christmas narratives? Which Gospels, which do we turn to for that? Daniel. Luke is good. Luke is good. Which part? There's somebody behind you whispering. Yes. Well, yeah, 1 and 2. That's for chapters 1 and 2. Where else do we turn? Only two Gospel narratives generally have it. What's that? Well, it looks like I'm going to need to. What do you think? John actually does. It's interesting because it doesn't specifically mention it, but actually the Word became flesh and dwelt among us is part of that. It's not typically what we return to for the, but and it's not Mark. So where else? Matthew. There we are. All right. So chapters 1 and 2 of Matthew and of 1 and 2 of Luke are where we find all the main things we think of as a Christmas story. We're going to turn to the last of the accounts, which is Matthew chapter 2. And we're going to read the whole chapter. I want to turn to that today and just find it a fascinating story. And so Matthew chapter 2. And although we're going to take a look at, in particular, these magi, the wise men, and some of the other characters involved here, and get to know the story a little bit differently, or at least focus in on particular parts of it, our goal is to have an increased appreciation of what God was doing. And also, what could our response be as we go from reading this, we see what was being put in place for us. I'm going to read through the whole chapter, reading from the New American Standard Version. It says this, Matthew 2, verse 1. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Gathering together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They said to him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for this is what has been written by the prophet." This is quoting from Micah chapter 5. It says, "And you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Then Herod secretly called the Magi and determined from them the exact time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. And when you have found him, report to me, so that I too may come and worship him." Should I say that in a sarcastic voice? Anyway, after hearing the king, they went their way. And the star which they had seen in the east went on before them until it came and stood over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. After coming into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell on the ground and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they presented to him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned by God in a dream not to return to Herod, the Magi left for their own country by another way. Now, when they had gone, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him." So Joseph got up and took the child and his mother while it was still night and left for Egypt. He remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Then when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he became very enraged and sent and slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and all its vicinity from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the Magi. Then what had been spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to be comforted because they were no more. But when Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go into the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead." So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother and came into the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Then, after being warned by God in a dream, he left for the regions of Galilee and came and lived in a city called Nazareth. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophets, "He shall be called a Nazarene." So I'd like to break into this, and using good questioning tactics, the five W's and one H, who, what, when, where, why, and how. We're going to break this down a little bit and just move through fairly quickly. I am going to put the who and the where together because you kind of can't really separate that with the particular descriptions we're going to need to do. The predominant group I want to focus on, of course, are these magi. So who are they? Well, one of the things I will say right at the outset is there's lots of things that have been added to the Christmas story over the years. Lots of things read into our Bibles that are not there. Now, that doesn't mean they're not true. Maybe they are true. Maybe they're not, but they're not here. Some extra-biblical things are possible for us to look at. For example, it mentions King Herod. We can look in history when Herod reigned, that kind of thing. So when they name people or events, we can use those to our advantage. But as far as the Magi go, we have almost no idea, no factual stuff to go by from the Bible. But the name itself does give us a sense. We do know that they're from the East. That's one of the where, so there's a who and a where together. The word itself seems to be, it was used later in the New Testament. Book of Acts, for example, there was Simon the sorcerer in Acts chapter 8, right? Same word. It's also a word that is translating from the Old Testament where we see in Pharaoh's court back in the days of Joseph when they're trying to figure out the dream. And also then in Exodus when they're trying to duplicate Moses' miracles or God's miracles through Moses and Aaron. It's the same thing. So it seems to be tied in with kind of that sense of sorcery and divining. They were apparently astrologers. And you know, scientific mind people, but we're not really too sure much about them. But they said they're from the East. Now, people have speculated. There are different arguments. Some have suggested actually a place that's more to the West. So I don't know how they come up with that. But they seem to have been, when they say the East in the Bible, it generally means past the Euphrates, right? So past the Euphrates River. Otherwise, it's kind of in the same region. You think of that, especially when you think of Abraham's journeys, and he had to come all the way over. So the most prominent view is that these were probably people of the courts from the historic Persian background. Now, the Persian Empire was not in place at the time of Jesus' birth. The Romans were ruling everything, but the Romans tended to allow the religions to continue, as we can see very clearly here, that we've got the temple in Jerusalem and places like that. And as long as people paid their taxes and didn't cause uprisings and so on, and all death penalties were given over to the hands of the Romans to decide and so on, even King Herod, who killed a lot of people, including his own family members, had to get permission from Rome to do it. But they were allowed to run. So we can see that in lots of places in the Bible, in the New Testament, how the Romans kind of let things sort of happen, and as long as it stayed under relative control, it was okay. So there were people practicing different religions within the Roman Empire, and there were people with different governments in the Roman Empire. These people seem to be from east of the Euphrates River area, and so Persia, that kind of, which we might know from modern, from old Babylon, that kind of region, or maybe further east than that, we're not sure. How far away they were at the time, we're not told. Any of that. We have no idea how long this trek took because we have no idea where they actually came from. Well, at least no proof of where they came from. Were they kings? Almost certainly not, because that probably would have said so. And there would have been a political piece to this, probably in the story. There is nothing of that here. These are just magi. It's a word. They're probably wise men in the sense of advisors to a court. They might be involved in government, but they're not likely kings, because there probably would have been some, nor are they representing a king. How do I say that with relative confidence? Well, there's nothing said in their comments about being there on behalf of someone, which they would have if they were envoys for political purposes. They would have to have said that. That would be part of honoring the king they were representing. They did no such thing. These people had come up with this idea through their own commitment, not because they were necessarily sent from somebody else in higher authority. So who they are, what they did, how many were there? I have difficulty singing some songs when I don't find the facts in the Bible, but anyway. But I will sing We Three Kings, so anybody picking that, don't worry. I'm not judging you. But we have no idea, except that it's in the plural, right? We don't know if there were three. We know there are three gifts named, and that's what tends to go. We have zilch evidence of Caspar, Melchior, and all these people, right? We have no idea who these people are. We don't. And if anybody tells you they're from different countries, this actually contradicts that, right? Because they return to their own country by another way. It said in verse 12. So they didn't necessarily, and how would they have connected anyway, probably, right? They didn't have email. So as far as that goes, it's reasonable for us to say they were all from the same place, and they rallied together, and they studied this star, which I'll come back to in a minute, and then they moved. But one of the cool things is they're Gentiles by all likelihood. Were they under the influence of Daniel then? That's what I personally think. We're going to study Daniel. I don't know if you're aware of that, but we're going to do a detailed book study of Daniel starting January 1st. And we're going to go right through to the middle of April with a couple of breaks in there. So some of what would be backup for this, I'm not going to say today, because that'll come out in somebody's message along the way in there. But it's quite possible, given the name Magi being something that seems to be tied to that Persian area and so on, that it was... they might have been influenced by what Daniel taught. Now, Daniel was the only person in the Old Testament who was given timelines for the prophecies. And it's fascinating. Again, we're going to study those in the new year. But Daniel's prophecies specifically indicated how all the Gentile rule would come crashing to an end. And there would be a king who would be raised up, who would be king forever. But it was also clear that it's all tied to the Jews. And so how would these magi know that this was the king of the Jews? Well, Daniel was the leader of the magi back in his day. He was in charge of them, and his records were documented, and we still have them today, right? And so these scholars would no doubt have had access to these things. And so when they see this star show up, that, again, is a bit of a mystery to us, but they did have Daniel's records available to them. And there was a great degree of respect for Daniel. So I can't prove that that's the connection, but it is a valid biblical connection we could make. As to how these people would have any clue that Jerusalem would be the place they should show up to, and was it just because was the star hanging overhead of Jerusalem? Well, it doesn't say that. It doesn't tell us what they saw when they were in the east. They saw the star. But they figured out in their studies that this star had to do with King of Jews. And so what they put together, how they studied it, is a bit of a mystery to us. And I don't know if these people put their trust in Christ. We're going to see them someday. Maybe they got a chance to hear the gospel later. I don't know. But they seem to have believed what was taught and were prepared to go and do something about it. We're going to come back to that. Where did they go? So the next person we encounter here is, I'm saving Jesus for a little bit later on in this, but Herod is the next other character that we meet in here, and he, of course, he's brought up, and I don't want to go into a detailed study. I've been warned by my wife not to share everything I was studying, we do have two of the Herod family mentioned here. Herod the Great is the one that's mentioned here, who is not so great in his morals and his attitude, but he was great in the sense of what he accomplished in his building projects and leadership and so on. He's actually a pretty amazing guy in some ways, but so was Hitler. But he had huge problems with his morals and his beliefs and his arrogance and his pride and so on. Herod was like a lot of those despots, right? He accomplished a lot of things and managed to do a lot of political intrigue, but one of the things is he was not the rightful king. Right, Herod was actually of an Edomite background, if anything, from Esau's race. But he was probably Arabic background based on his mother's heritage, and was appointed to be the king. Caesar had allowed him to be king of the region following a bit of a power struggle. His father and grandfather had been involved in political leadership, and he ended up being placed in charge of the entire region. At his death, he had arranged in his will if Rome would agree to it, to have his kingdom divided among three of his sons and one of his daughters, or his I don't know how many daughters he had, but one daughter anyway. She had a small piece of it, and the biggest piece went to the Archelaus, who's mentioned here, who was more of a tyrant than his father was, and didn't reign for only reigned for 10 years before being exiled by Rome. You can tell he was not favored. But Herod was not the rightful king, and he had killed off other people who had tried to become king, or he thought were trying to take his kingdom, including one of his favorite wives. He had many wives, and two of his sons, who were her sons, just recently, like within 2 or 3 years of this story, probably, he had killed two of his sons for suspicion that they were wanting to take his place. And before he would die, and sometime within the next year or so of this event, he would kill another of his sons, his firstborn, again, for the same thing, because of this threat to the throne. So he's not opposed to killing people who are wanting to take his place, or he thinks are wanting to take his place. So you can be sure that he was, verse 3, when it says, when Herod heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Well, Herod was actually going a bit crazy by this point in history. He had a lot of relatively stable years, if you can call a tyrant stable, but he was actually making all kinds of weird things and getting himself out of favor in Rome, in fact. But he was not a stable person, and he was very, very paranoid by this point. So you can imagine why Jerusalem was all upset with him. It's because they don't want the king to do anything, right? It unsettles the population when your king is unsettled, right? You don't know what's going to happen. Will there be war? What's going to happen here? And they knew that he had a track record of brutality. So all of that to say that there was trouble. But the interesting thing is, he's the one who initiates it and says, where's the Messiah to be born? So he knew this title, King of the Jews, was a reference to the Messiah. Now, he knew he was not the rightful king. A matter of fact, Joseph, Jesus' legal father, was the heir to the throne. But he was at Nazareth and had come down to Bethlehem. He is of the lineage of David. He was the firstborn, and his son became the legal heir to the throne. And so the king of the Jews being born was a very important thing to Herod, because this is somebody who could rightfully claim it if he's really there, because he knew he was not the rightful heir to the throne. He was appointed heir. He was appointed to the throne and wanted to keep it at all costs. Now, so he consults the chief priests and the scribes. That's another group that's mentioned here in verse 4. And they seem to know. But what I think is so fascinating about this is that this has now gone public. Right? This is one of the most significant things about this story, is that God used these people to stir up a very public statement about the arrival of the king. Up to this point, we've had other testimonies, the shepherds and so on, but who has credibility, right? When you can go, we can have Gentile advisors, possibly with some kind of official titles, we don't know, showing up, looking to honor the king of the Jews who's been born, and they know historically this is supposed to be the Messiah, and the chief priests and the scribes are able to identify the verse in Micah 5:2 that tells us that in Bethlehem of Judea, that's the southern Bethlehem, there is a northern Bethlehem, but back in those days, but they have it's the southern one of Judea, is going to have this ruler. And he will, so this is a ruler who's a shepherd at the same time. So they're very aware that the scriptures would be fulfilled if that were the case. And it's on the, and they believe it's true. And the Magi believe it's true, because where do they go next? They go to Bethlehem, right? They don't think, oh, that's just fiction. That's just a legend. They believe it's true. And Herod doesn't treat it as a legend either. He believes this could really be true. And he does that subtle and duplicitous thing where he's saying, oh, you go and find out. Now, I was reading something a while back. The person said, Herod's big mistake is he should have sent an envoy with them, because then he would have been able to know the location himself instead of depending on these guys. Well, because of that, he didn't. And unfortunately, many innocent lives were destroyed as a result of this man's maniacal attitude. But we have these people heading off at the prompting of the chief priests, based on the authority of Scripture, the next place we learn about is Bethlehem. And, of course, that's a place we well know through Christmas story, but that's where David was from, right? And then, so the rightful heir to the throne is from David's line, and that's where Joseph had gone. We don't really know if Joseph had made a permanent home in Nazareth before when he met Mary, or whether he was still from Bethlehem and was working there in his trades. We don't really know Joseph's personal location, but that's where his family was from, and as I said already, he's the rightful heir to the throne when you look at Matthew's genealogy in the previous chapter to see where Joseph fits in there. They're in Bethlehem at this point, and I'll get to the timing of all this in a few moments, but as far as this goes, the Magi show up there, and we'll come back to talk about the star in a moment. But the other person that's really mentioned here, of course, is Jesus, and there are various titles being used for him here. One of them is King of the Jews, we saw in verse 2. And that's fascinating to have that in Matthew's account, because Matthew's theme is the kingdom and the king. He's known for that compared to the other authors of the Gospels. That's a very strong theme of Matthew's, and so interestingly, that's recorded by Matthew. Whereas the things that Luke records are different from what Matthew records, and they complement each other and tell the rest of the story. So he's the King of the Jews. He's the Messiah, it said in verse 4. The ruler and shepherd in verse 6. It's in verse 15, it says, out of Egypt I called my son. God taking responsibility for that statement. We're not going to analyze that one, but it means God's son is another thing we could say is a title is there. And the very last verse of the chapter, it talks about being called a Nazarene. We're not really getting into it. That's not an actual scripture quotation per se, but the word Nazarene means the idea of branch or outcast. And he was both. He was despised and rejected, and he grew up before him as a branch, and he was also the branch that was promised from David's line, things like that. So there, it's probably a way to collectively put some prophecies together, but I'm not going to get into all that. I want to focus in on the Magi and that event. And of course, there's Mary and Joseph mentioned. Mary, specifically named here in verse 11, when the Magi show up at the house. Now, Joseph isn't mentioned as being there, but according to custom, these men would not be showing up in the house with a lady by herself. There, so Joseph was probably around somewhere, but he was not prominent here because it was Mary with the child. And so it's a child with Mary. So there's that focal point of where their work, and that's not what Joseph wanted attention for anyway. But Joseph is mentioned, and I know I've shared before about Joseph. He's such an amazing character, so many things to learn about him. But notice his obedience saved their life, right? Because in a dream, which he'd had dreams before, chapter 1, that's how he knew to go ahead and keep Mary as his wife, and that the child would be called Jesus and so on, and he'd be the Savior. But all of that, Joseph is very responsive, and in the night, while it's still night, he got up and took them away. He didn't pause. He took by faith, and he went. And because of that, he was able to be an agent by which God saved the life of Jesus and preserved the line. And so we have them. And then, of course, as far as locations go, we have the country of the Magi that they return to. We don't know what country it was. We have Joseph and Mary and Jesus going off to Egypt for a period of time. And there are records to back that up. The Egyptian Christians have some stuff they have on writings to support that. And then they come back to the region after Herod dies. We see that they realize Archelaus is in charge, and that scares them. And God confirms, don't bother going there, go to Nazareth. Now, they had been from Nazareth, obviously, but they seemed to have planned not to return. And Joseph was poor, and as a result, possibly had just decided, let God lead us where he's leading us. But they ended up back in Nazareth and made it their home, and that's where Jesus was raised, as we see more about in Luke's account. So that's the who and the where. As far as the what, well, there's a few things we've already looked at, but the what that stands out, of course, is the star, right? This is a prominent feature, but I've watched videos about this. Some of you may have too. I'm not going to name it because I don't actually agree with it. So there's a lot of attempt for us to make everything fit whatever the world could study. There's a danger in doing that. God was clearly doing something special here. And this was not a normal star. How do we know that? it moved. Right? It specifically says that it relocated itself. Right? Verse 10. It says, when they saw the star, verse 9 first, and hearing the king, they went their way, and the star which they had seen in the east, so that's when they were in the east and saw the star, went on before them until it came and stood over the place where the child was. Where's Bethlehem compared to Jerusalem? Even more dramatic, it's south by about 10 kilometers, give or take. That's if Google Maps, you can check that part out. Right, modern day, anyway, it's about 10 kilometers. I don't know how long it would have taken to get there in their day. But that star specifically moved. So this is one that is probably not even in the realm of the other stars as far as its location. It's probably a lot lower down and more visible. But we don't know. But the point is that this thing was not normal. But it got their attention somehow. One thing God does not condone is worship that goes elsewhere. And astrology is a false religion. And he would not be condoning astrology as his method. Now, he can use sinful people, but he does not condone it. And so astrology is what these people were part of worshiping. Or at least that was part of their worship practice, the Magi. At least that culture group, whether these particular people were or not, I can't say because we don't know who they are. But I do know this, is that God was doing a work and he got their attention somehow by having this star that they noticed. Now these are, if they are scholars of the stars, this thing stood out to them. This is not normal. This is not normally there. And you can watch videos and they talk about different things aligning and so on. I would suggest just ignore all that. Don't be in a rush, because I'm prone in that direction because I'm a sciencey kind of guy. I want to have answers. My curiosity says I'd like to know. But a lot of times that's my own pride that is trying to make it all packaged together. God doesn't limit himself to these things. God didn't tell us all these things. So we don't need to let science validate our Bibles. We need to be careful. There's never been a true, real contradiction on anything significant. And it's very important for us to realize that God sometimes only tells us what we need to know. The secret things belong to God, but the things revealed are for us and for our children. Deuteronomy 29:29, great verse. So a lot of skeptics say, well, for example, we're going to get to this in the timing, but Luke makes mention of Quirinius, governor of Syria, and the records don't show us exactly the timelines matching up in a really smooth way in some of that. So a lot of skeptics say, see, there's errors. No. If they were just a little more cautious in their pride, they'd realize almost every time that somebody has raised a skepticism about what the Bible teaches about history or archaeology, it eventually gets proven to be accurate. It's happened so many times, it's wise for people to just keep their mouth shut, right? Because, and I say that with boldness, because God is worthy of our honor and praise. He does not have to tell us everything that we want to know. And if we try to make it all fit, we may get into places that kind of mess with our minds because he hasn't told us everything. And sometimes we say, well, it's missing something, therefore I'm doubting now. You don't need to doubt God. Some of these things may piece themselves together before we're done in our lives. Some of them may not. But there aren't any real contradictions that God's ever put in here. So somehow it works out. And that's not just a matter of faith, that's a matter of fact, because that's how God has always worked. We can back it up. Even a bunch of non-believers have seen that pattern, that it tends to work out. So I want to stress that point, that don't worry too much about trying to figure out which of the stars in current existence it is. My personal belief is it's not there anymore. It was invented for a purpose, and it was there for one purpose, and it was done. I could be wrong on that, but it is definitely portrayed that way in this story. That's a unique thing that they saw in the east. Now, did they follow the star as they traveled? Doesn't say that. We have no knowledge of what the star was doing. We just know it showed up 2 years prior to this event, right? Because that's what they told Herod, is when it had appeared. And so does that mean Jesus was born back then? No, not necessarily. But the star appeared then. God was preparing them to come. And they would come and show up where they should show up, which is in the center of Jewish life, and the Jewish government. If they're looking for the king of the Jews, where would you go? Jerusalem, right? And so they were brought by God through this study to that, to know that it should be in that location that they should show up and inquire. Now, they didn't know if the king would be in that location, but the star was what got their attention. But God is the one prompting and giving the leading. And look at verse 10. I love that verse. It says, when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. What a really powerful statement that is, right? They were pretty excited. Rejoiced greatly, right? Exceedingly with great joy. They had treasures with them, right? But they were treasuring something else, right? They were so excited that this star was now visible again to them and moved to over the place where they, so they could be taken directly to the one they were really looking for. That's a miracle. That's not science. It might match, it might not, but it's a miracle of God that he's at work doing. And so whatever it is, it was directly used by God to bring those people directly to where Jesus was. That's amazing. Let's not trivialize it by trying to make it fit some other thing. God was doing something, however he chose to do it, he was the one responsible for that star, and he brought it to that location because he wanted to bring them to that location. And as far as we know, that's it. And they came to that house. And the gifts they offered. Again, lots of things have been built in about gold, frankincense, and myrrh. You can read those for yourself. You probably have heard about gold being representing his kingliness, frankincense being his divine nature, and because it was the kind of incense used in special combination with other things as sacrifice in the temple, as well as for other purposes. But there was a special incense, by the way, for the temple, but it used some of this stuff. And myrrh, people tend to refer to that for the burial of Jesus and his death. These things might be true. I don't think that's really necessarily the point of them being included here. They were expensive and they were rare and they were tribute. And they were worthy of a king and they did represent divine offering. That much we can sure say. Now, if you want to add significance to the meaning of these things, that's fine because the Bible sometimes gives us little pictures like that. It may well be, but I don't believe that's what we're supposed to bother with here, nor their identity. That's why these things aren't elaborated on. What really matters is that they were offering, they brought with them some expensive, rare things to pay tribute to this particular baby. That's amazing, this child that was born. Now, the other thing that stands out, notice how many references to dreams there were in here. But what's neat about these magi is they responded to the dreams too. Right, they had one. We don't know exactly. Probably the night before they showed up, I'm guessing, before they showed up to the house where Mary and Jesus were. I'm not sure, but in verse 12, having been warned by God in a dream not to return to Herod, the Magi left for their own country by another way. So as they went out from visiting, which was probably toward the nighttime or at least late afternoon, because they saw the star in a prominent way. But anyway, they went to their own country, but they responded in a dream. So that shows that God was trying to communicate with people, and he was clear in his communication with Joseph a few times and with the Magi. And so God is taking initiative here. He sent the dreams, as he often did in other parts of the Bible. He sent the dreams to alert people to something, and it's very evident that he was orchestrating events and moving people according to that as they responded to him, and that's a good lesson for us too. They avoided Herod in the process, and that, of course, really ticked him off. That's an understatement. He was very enraged, it says, because of that. His plan was foiled, and he went ahead and killed all these innocent babies. We have no idea how many there were at the time that were 2 years old and under in the region of Bethlehem. It wasn't a large place, but we could only be speculating as to how many there are, but it was a tragic, terrible thing that other dictators in history have done too. And we think of Moses' time, right? Pharaoh back then trying to kill off baby boys. The devil has always wanted to try to destroy the work of God, especially the line of the Messiah. And here he attempted it one more time through somebody who was very given over to evil things. And he didn't succeed, right? And Jesus was spared because Joseph had listened and they went out. But there's that prophecy that was given by Jeremiah that talks about Rachel, who is the mother of Benjamin and Joseph, and Benjamin's region was that part of the territory. It was tragic. But as far as that goes, they managed to avoid their own death, and they triggered Herod. I want to read to you, you don't need to turn there, but in Psalm 146, verse 9, it says, "The Lord protects the strangers, he supports the fatherless and the widow, but he thwarts the way of the wicked." There are many other verses we could turn to, Psalm 146, verse 9. The Lord was having his say. And when you look at this passage, you also see several prophecies that got fulfilled. I'm not going to elaborate on them, because they're here and we can study them, because I have to wrap up. But there are several prophecies being fulfilled here, not the least of which is that one from Micah chapter 5, verse 2. And I just leave a little homework with you. Go read the next few verses in Micah 5, from verses 2 to the beginning of verse 5. Verse 2 to 5, there's actually some really significant stuff in there that I'll leave for your own enjoyment that actually echoes some of what was going on here. As far as timing goes, the when, I'm just going to quickly breeze through this because I want to get to the wrap-up part. The timing, the main thing we know about is timed with Herod's death. That's the thing historically that's mentioned here. Luke 2 does mention some other things. It mentions Quirinius, governor of Syria, and a census that Caesar put out. A little bit tricky to nail that down. Some disputes about that. I'm not going to get into all that. It's a bit distracting. But as I said, history has proven that not to worry too much. These things tend to make themselves clear. But as far as that goes, though, we also have the advantage in Luke chapter 3 of having many officials listed there before it introduces John the Baptist. And it says several different political leaders in different parts of the world and in that region, as well as religious leaders and so on. We do have records of those people. And if you back up the age span of John, which was about 30 at the time he started his ministry, just like, or at least when Jesus started his ministry, he was about 30, which means somewhere before he turned 31. If you back up 31 years from that time period of John's ministry, you get to right around, just a little while before Herod died. You don't really need the reference in Luke 2 to figure that out. If there's any confusion, God has always got ways, right? You can actually back up and you can realize. So how old was Jesus at the time? He was a child, it says here, but don't read into that he was 2, right? Because the star appeared when he was 2 years before that, but they didn't jump on the camels or something and head off right away, right? They would have been studying for a while. And so on. So was he born then? Maybe he was. But if he was born according to what Luke says, if we put Luke's account together, I'll leave it for your own study. You can read up stuff on this. Luke's account, if you overlap those events with Herod's life at the last little bit of his life, you realize that Jesus was probably only a few months old at the time that the escape to Egypt happened. I'm not going to push that point right now, even though I strongly believe it, but for the sake of time. But one of the things that's important here, we also have studied this before, but the Magi showed up after Jesus was 40 days old. Right? How do we know that? If anybody memorized anything I said before, but we studied. But I didn't say it today. How do we know that the Magi, or Joseph and Mary, were not in possession of the Magi's gifts at the time that they dedicated Jesus? They gave the gift only poor people were allowed to give, right? 2 turtle doves instead of the proper lamb and so on, ram. And so they would not have done that as righteous people if they had money available to them. They had very expensive things. But they had a flight to Egypt. They had to live away with no means. God was providing for them. These gifts were very, very tangible, marketable products that could cover all their expenses and be generous people at that. Now, I'm perhaps reading into that, but that's how God has always worked. I mean, just last week I was reading how he helped Peter pay his taxes by having him go fish. And say, you're going to get a coin. You can pay for my tax and yours, right? God provides. Feeding of the 5,000 and so on. God provides. He has ways to do it. And so they didn't have the gifts at the time that Jesus was 40 days old. So sometime after that, they showed up. But it had to all work out to be they go away to Egypt for a while, and then Herod dies, and they come back. So there's a period of time in there we're not sure, and it's not something we should divide over, even if you're wrong. Somewhat of a joke. Anyway, as far as that goes, the Lord was at work. That's the main thing. Why did they come? They came to worship. That's what we know. These people came to worship. Did they get anything out of it? Was there anything political in it? Any deals arranged? There's nothing. Right? They got something out of it. Their hearts were rejoicing. They got to meet the baby king. But they had no, there seems to be nothing other than plain belief and worship. If they did believe what Daniel had taught, these people were excited to see the fulfillment of what God was at work doing. And that's what motivated them. It took them a long time to get from wherever they were, to prepare, to study, and so on, get there, spend this money on these gifts, get there, do this, and then turn around and go right back. That's a pretty serious plan. There seems to be nothing but worship that is the idea. And they fell prostrate down before this baby. Right? That's what that word means. They were right down on their faces before this. They were honoring this child. And we have no knowledge whether they followed up later on to know what happened with his life. We have nothing to go by. They're here for us to learn from, to see how Jesus should be treated, how Jesus should be honored. But one of the things that's really crucial about all that is that it's very consistent with what we're going to study in Daniel. Some of these great kings along the way, Nebuchadnezzar, his grandson Belshazzar, Darius the Mede, Cyrus the Persian, Xerxes, Artaxerxes, these guys all had encounters with how great God was and how God was in charge of it all and how he moved events, right? Did these people maybe believe that from the lessons learned from history as they studied it and they were willing to identify with that God? It seems to be that way. But the main thing I want to take away from this is God was doing the prompting. He brought them to validate Jesus. That's why they came. Whatever else might be there, that's why this story exists, is that God was raising up Gentiles to come into Jerusalem, to the land of the Jews, and seek the King of the Jews, who was much more than just the King of the Jews. He was the promised Messiah that would be for all. And they were willing to bow before him. They were willing for him to be their king. And so he's more than the king of the Jews in their mind. And he was prompting that. He also stirred up the issue we read about this morning. Class was reading about Zechariah. This was not the first time Jerusalem has been stirred by something that happened a few months before this. Zechariah, one of the priests, had gone mute for 9 months after a vision, and it was public knowledge. And who are the people that looked up the prophecy for Herod? It was the chief priests. Zacharias was a priest. They knew something was happening. John was raised up. The forerunner that was prophesied was raised up. This was public knowledge. The Messiah had to be coming soon. And this validated it, that God's agenda was happening. And anybody who had a heart for knowing God's truth would have been very interested in following. Anybody who did not like it would be very bothered by it. And Herod was that person, and so were others. And so we're learning a lot of lessons. How did they do it? They were purposeful. They were thoughtful. They were wise. They were humble. They were generous. You can elaborate on those yourselves. But that's how they did their work. But the Magi would not want us, I'm going to wrap up with this. The Magi would not want us to focus on them, because that wasn't their focus. They wanted to focus on Jesus. And so what is our response to it? Let's put it into practice for ourselves. How ready are we to put Christ first and to set aside our comforts and give our resources in order to worship him, whatever that may be? How sensitive are we to be led by God? That's a good question. They were sensitive to be led by God. They would invest in study. They took their time. They took it seriously. They listened to him. The dreams, they believed it, and they were led. They were not doing it because of emotion, but they had emotion, right? They were not impulsive or any of that, but they knew the word. At least it's fair to say, but do we know the word? That's what they knew, we don't know. What do we know? Do we know the word, and can we go ahead and live it out? And lastly, that verse 10 where it says, they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. Let me just read you one verse to close. 1 Peter 1:8. And though you have not seen him, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory. And so, Lord, we look forward to your second coming, when you're going to take your church away and then later establish your kingdom here. And you're going to set things right in even a more future day than that. But you are the king. You are the only real king. You are the rightful king of the Jews, and you're the king of the Gentiles too. You're the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And though you came in such a humble way, the world did need to know. And thank you for alerting us and putting it into these records of history. And we thank you that you have the final say, and that you want to lead us and direct us and use us for your glory and to influence the lives of others and to encourage other people as these Magi encourage Mary and Joseph as well. We ask you, Lord, to use our lives the way you want them to be used, and may we do so willingly for your glory. Amen.